In the current structure, dollars can either be earned by delivering value to others within the economy, or conversely, if the Fed decides to hand out more money. This happens quite frequently. Of all the dollars that exist today, over 80% have been created and allocated by the Fed since 2008, rather than by the alternative, delivering value to others within the economy. Which system sounds more fair, balanced, and conducive to aligning incentives throughout an economy over decades and generations? The best in Bitcoin made audible. I'm Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. Yo, what's up, guys? This new intro music gets me jacked. We are back. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I love it when I get my Swan, you just stacked with Swan Bitcoin email, which I just got. It was last week. I just got another auto withdrawal, so I am stacking and it is going automatically to my own keys. And it just feels so good to know that I don't have to babysit that. And anything that I want to buy in my Lightning wallets, I just do it Strike really quick. But if you want to do that, you got to get on Strike and you got to get on Swan Bitcoin. SwanBitcoin.com/guy is the place to do that. And they also have the lowest fees for, you know, dollar cost averaging. So, you know, there's that. But you know, if you listen to yesterday's show, what we are reading today, we are finishing Parker Lewis's amazing Bitcoin is One for All, the most recent installment in the Gradually Then Suddenly series at Unchained Capital. And we're not going to waste any more time. We're going to jump right into it. Again, this is part two of Bitcoin is One for All. Jumping into the section, Consequences of Sustaining Imbalance. The effects of sustaining imbalance can be best understood and observed through the credit system, because that is where the Fed directly intervenes, and consequently where the greatest distortion and imbalance exists. As the economy slows, and as price levels begin to change counter to the Fed's desired course, the Fed increases the supply of dollars in the financial system by purchasing debt instruments, typically government treasuries, and crediting the accounts of the sellers with newly minted dollars. At the onset, the credit system was just a tool to affect monetary policy. It was the mechanism through which the Fed pursued price stability. Increase the supply of dollars by purchasing credit instruments. Reduce interest rates by that same mechanism. Induce economic expansion via cheap credit and cause general price levels to stabilize. That was the theory and intent. However, predictably, this pattern caused imbalances to form and be sustained in the credit system itself. Now the tail is wagging the dog. Today, the credit system in the U.S. stands at $77.9 trillion system-wide, whereas there are only $4.5 trillion actual dollars within the banking system. For every dollar that exists, approximately $17 of dollar-denominated debt exists. Debt to dollars of 17 to 1. Again, this is an imbalance only made possible and sustained as a function of the Fed. Each time the credit system attempts to contract, the Fed creates more dollars to help maintain the size of the credit system, such that it can further expand. Because the credit system is now orders of magnitude larger than the base money supply, economic activity today is largely coordinated by the allocation and expansion of credit, rather than the base money itself. In aggregate, the credit system is the marginal price setter, given its size relative to the base money supply. Because of its price stability mandate, the Fed has an implicit mandate to maintain the size of the credit system, and in order to do so, it must target asset prices that support existing debt levels. It has become circular. The Fed used the credit system as a tool to stabilize price levels, but now it must maintain the size of the credit system in order to maintain stable prices. a chart of all sectors, debt, securities, and loans, liability at level from the Federal Reserve. Debt in the U.S. has increased from $1.7 trillion in 1971 to $78 trillion in 2020. This would not be possible if not for the Fed's manipulation of the money supply. This equals the imbalance sustained. This vicious cycle was only ever made possible because the Fed has unilateral control of the money supply. In 1971, President Nixon officially ended all convertibility of dollars to gold, and the U.S. government later decoupled the value of the dollar from gold altogether in 1976. While the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913 was the beginning, and President Roosevelt's executive order in 1933, banning private ownership of gold, set the stage, the complete departure from gold as a monetary anchor in the 1970s removed constraints that otherwise prevented the true centralization of the money supply, and which ultimately enabled the great monetary inflation which Paul Tudor Jones recently wrote about. Once the final constraints were removed, it opened the door for the Fed to take a more central role in actively managing the economy via the money supply, which it ultimately affects through the credit system. As a direct consequence, the base money supply and the credit system have expanded in ways that would otherwise not have been possible, allowing imbalances to consistently grow over time and creating long-term economic distortions. The disconnect between productivity and a typical worker's compensation from 1948 to 2014. From 1948 to 1973, productivity grew 96.7%, while hourly compensation grew a comparable 91.3%. Between 1973 and 2014, productivity grew 72.2%. Hourly compensation grew a measly 9.2%. When imbalances emerge in the credit system, for example, too much debt existing, the Fed supplies more dollars such that existing debt levels can be sustained. Rather than write off bad debt and reduce existing debt levels, imbalances are actively sustained rather than eliminated. This is the real reason why the banking sector and the function of credit has become as large as it has. It would not have been possible if the Fed were not able to print money to artificially sustain unsustainable levels of debt, all in the interest of price stability. Effectively, each time the banking sector would otherwise contract, the Fed takes measures to actively prevent it. It sounds crazy, because it is. But it exists the way it does because the credit system is the primary transmission mechanism of the Fed's monetary policy. The Fed needs the credit system to be maintained because it is through this vehicle that the Fed attempts to manage the economy. The Fed sees targeting asset prices to sustain debt levels as less disruptive than allowing debt to be restructured and written off. In the Fed's eyes, it's six one way, half a dozen the other. Effectively the same, but with less disruption. In reality, one path is economic manipulation of the worst kind, and the other is the natural and organic balancing of an economy in imbalance. The Fed chooses the former, trading short-term stability for long-term instability and distortion. While it should be obvious that asset price targeting advantages those with assets, the wealthy, and is a regressive tax on those without assets, the poor, the Fed has its price stability mandate. For those on the lower end of the economic spectrum with little to no savings, cash, naturally, represents most, if not all, of one's savings. On the other hand, those at the higher end of the economic spectrum typically hold cash in addition to equity in businesses, real estate, and financial assets, such as stocks and bonds. Again, consider the 2008 financial crisis. there were imbalances in both the housing market and financial markets. Prices within these markets were at unsustainable levels. As imbalance was being eliminated, and as price levels were correcting, the Fed stepped in to, quote, stabilize asset prices. Imagine that you were someone just entering the economy, without any savings, or you could not afford to purchase a home and likely did not own stocks or bonds. Everyone who owned assets was bailed out at the expense of those who did not, all in the interest of price stability. By increasing the supply of dollars to prop up asset prices, each dollar naturally becomes worth less. For those lowest on the economic spectrum, wages paid in dollars, labor, were devalued. The asset prices were directly manipulated higher. Inflation of most all consumer goods broadly followed. It is the equivalent of being hit from both sides. Wages purchase less and less day to day, and it becomes measurably more difficult to accumulate the amount of savings necessary to purchase assets. Initially, the effects are at best zero-sum. Those at the top benefit, those at the bottom suffer. In the end, everyone loses, because the end game is economic instability. Notice the negative correlation below between housing prices and housing affordability, and then recognize that housing prices are actively manipulated by the Fed. Also recognize that housing prices are at an all-time high above the 2007 bubble levels, when nearly half the country has no savings. That equation only exists in a manipulated world, and it crushes those without savings. Economists running the show, and those that benefit the most, will overwhelmingly agree it has to be done, every time. History is written by the winners, but it is still all smoke and mirrors.
Sure, it was a crazy experiment, but the Fed had no other choice. Just imagine all those on the lower end of the spectrum that would have lost their jobs if not for the Fed's actions. Without a job, the poorest on the economic spectrum would have been far worse off and would not have been able to afford a home.
At least, this is the common, predictable defense. The same line has certainly been used to defend the Fed's most recent actions in response to the global pandemic, printing $3 trillion with a T. While it may seem like logic, it is an anecdote that lacks any fundamental economic argument in defense of the manipulation of price levels. The narrative is caught in a vicious cycle that begins with economic imbalance as a starting point, and one created by decades of the same distortive monetary policy. Recall the role of arsonist, hailed as a hero fighting the fire. You cannot dig yourself out of a hole by continuing to dig in the same direction. At a fundamental level, manipulating price levels allows imbalances that would otherwise course correct to be sustained. It disproportionately advantages those that contributed to and benefited the most from the very existence of imbalance, like having your cake and eating it too, or like getting a second bite at the apple. Those most directly bailed out took an inadvisable risk, and rather than be penalized, the world of imbalance was sustained. The advantages gained from manipulated incentive structures are allowed to continue in a way that would not be possible absent the Fed's policy decisions. An unmanipulated economic structure. While there is never perfect balance, the existence and fluctuation of price levels is how an economy works toward balance through trial and error. Every individual reacts to an ever-changing set of price signals. It is how people evaluate which businesses to create, which skill sets to acquire, and which jobs to pursue, all of which are interdependent on each individual's own interests and capabilities. Imbalances can naturally arise within an economy as individuals speculate and overinvest in certain segments based on imperfect expectations of consumer preferences. That is the nature of trial and error. Nobody knows or can predict the future. They use price signals to best guide decisions. A business or individual produces a good for X and attempts to sell it for Y, And if insufficient demand exists to make the activity profitable, that is the market communicating information to the producer. Better luck next time. Build it for less, or build something else that is of greater value or valued by more people. Imbalances are eliminated. Those that took the risk own the consequences, and it's back to the drawing board in a never-ending game aimed at marrying individual ideas and skill sets with the preferences of other market participants. Quote, prices and profits are all that most producers need to be able to serve the needs of men they do not know. They are tools for searching. Just as for the soldier or hunter or seaman, the telescope extends the range of vision. Friedrich Hayek. Money is the tool that is used to coordinate resources and to test the market by trial and error. It becomes the lifeblood of an economy because it is the foundation of a price system. It is how information is distributed to all participants. The better the money, the more reliable its price system, and the more reliable a price system, the greater the balance in an economy. Those within an economy that deliver the greatest value to the largest number of people are naturally rewarded with the most money. But money would be of little value to the producer if others were not producing goods that they themselves valued. The system would not sustain itself if balance did not exist. In order to purchase a good or service from another individual, one must have earned money in the first place. Acquiring money by voluntarily providing a service valued by others is a far better outcome for everyone in aggregate than if money were to be acquired through any other means. It is so because it's the only way for the cycle to be repeatable and symbiotic, rather than one-off and zero-sum. What good is a customer that runs out of money or doesn't have any in the first place? In a balanced economy, every producer is a customer of someone else, and vice versa.
Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach him how to fish and you feed him for a lifetime.
One need not be religious to understand the wisdom. Each individual benefits by having a large number of people producing more goods or services, and everyone is incentivized to produce output valued by others within an economy. Everyone has a selfish interest in both delivering value to others and in helping others to contribute value in return. But it is not just a naive or hopeful economic view of the world. There are discernible benefits to trade, specialization, and ultimately in a broader range of choice for all individuals, which organically dictates a division of labor. Money coordinates the division of labor. And the form of money with the most reliable pricing mechanism will consistently deliver the greatest value with the greatest range of choice and balance. The pricing mechanism with the least distortion provides the clearest signals as to what other people value, and derivatively provides the greatest assurance that the information communicated is not a false signal. The undistorted function of a monetary medium and its price system is what ensures imbalance is eliminated. It is the governor that allows for balance to be restored and for symbiotic relationships to continuously be discovered in a constant process of trial and error. A manipulated and broken economic structure. The Fed's monetary policy actively prevents the economy from restructuring and from finding balance. Efforts to maintain price stability when imbalance exists equates to maintaining otherwise false price signals. Productive assets remain in the hands of a few, and the world remains suspended in a state of imbalance. Money that makes its way to those on the lower end of the spectrum eventually finds its way back to those that controlled productive assets like a steel trap, because structural imbalances are never fixed. Instead, the natural healing process is stymied when the Fed intervenes. The structure of the economy cannot sustainably cycle money in a symbiotic way because balance does not exist. Skill sets and preferences of market participants are not aligned. The Fed pumping money into a structurally broken economy is akin to giving a man a fish and feeding him for a day, while at the same time preventing him from learning how to fish by sustaining false signals. The existence of imbalance signals that the composition of an economy is not meeting the needs of the participants that make up the market, or rather, that the assets and the individuals which capture the lion's share of wealth would not continue to do so if the economy was allowed to restructure. The Fed's economic structure produces inequity by preventing imbalances from rebalancing. That is what the market attempts to do every time the Fed steps in to keep the dream alive. Giving all benefits of the doubt, the Fed believes it is helping. The starting point of the Fed's economic theory is that active management of the money supply is a positive driving force. That is in its DNA. It is not questioned or debated. It sees its activities as smoothing out market signals rather than manipulating them. The question for all those within the four walls of the Fed is how much and when to manipulate the money supply, not if. Would anyone expect the Fed to be an honest evaluator of its actions? It would be like grading your own test. No one would reasonably expect an objective assessment because there can be no objectivity. Certain false assumptions are encoded in their brains as true, which prevents the possibility of objectivity. They look everywhere for answers but in the mirror, and try the same policies over and over again, always expecting a different result.
You know, inequality is something that's been with us increasingly for more than four decades, and it's not really related to monetary policy. It's more related to, there are a lot of theories on what causes it, but it's been something that's more or less been going up consistently for more than four decades, and there are a lot of different theories. One of which is just is that globalization and technology call for rising levels of skills and aptitudes and education, and that U.S. educational attainment kind of flattened out, certainly relative to our peers, flattened out over that period.
Jay Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve in June 2020. Fed Chairman Powell recently provided this as a response to a question asking whether Fed policy contributes to increasing wealth inequality. Notice how the response is not an argument as to why central bank policy does not cause imbalance and inequality. It is more of a pronouncement followed by a look over there defense. Never believe the myths about globalization and technology driving wealth inequality. There is nothing about technology, innovation, and globalization that causes sustained economic imbalance or a structurally expanding wealth gap within an economy. For innovation to be valuable, it by definition must solve problems for a range of people. But if those that valued it did not have money or means to afford the innovation, it wouldn't be valuable. Value becomes self-referencing in that sense. Economic balance is a governing input to value. In order to believe the tall tales of technology and globalization causing economic imbalance, one would have to be willfully blind to the impact of centralizing the money supply, which in turn caused banking to become the epicenter and lifeblood of the economy, and which made it possible for imbalance to actively be sustained over decades as a policy decision. There may be many theories, but the manipulation of every price signal within the economy is ground zero to economic imbalance and inequity. It is the structural flaw in the foundation which creates the unlevel playing field off of which all other contributing factors compound. If A, then B. If not A, then not B. Money is the bedrock of economic systems. Understanding the fundamental and foundational role money plays in the economic engine establishes the logical connection between systemic economic issues of imbalance and the artificial manipulation of the money supply. Of course, there are other factors at play. The money supply is not the only way economic activity is manipulated. Tax policy, government spending, and the regulatory apparatus all contribute. But focusing there would be like trying to fix the windows on the 100th floor when the bottom 10 stories are each being supported by a single Jenga block. That is the relationship between the issues inherent in the monetary system, the foundation, and all other economic issues, the higher levels. The core problem that Bitcoin solves is the foundation. If everyone were to display a little bit of humility, each would recognize that there is no silver bullet to solve the structural problem of a widening wealth gap and economic imbalance. There is no individual with a plan or piece of legislation that will make everything better. Imbalance created by central command does not get solved by central command. Quite the opposite. The only real hope is to first fix the foundation such that everyone on net can get back to doing the desirable things without the need for conscious control. Balance will follow from there. Quote, "But those who clamor for conscious direction and who cannot believe that anything which has evolved without design and even without our understanding it should solve problems which we should not be able to solve consciously should remember this. The problem is precisely how to extend the span of our utilization of resources beyond the span of the control of any one mind, and therefore how to dispense with the need of conscious control, and how to provide inducements which will make the individuals do the desirable things without anyone having to tell them what to do." Hayek, Use of Knowledge in Society. With a fixed supply of 21 million, enforced on a decentralized basis and controlled by no one, Bitcoin has taken away the ability to manipulate the monetary function entirely. If misbehaving children cannot find a way to share a toy and play nice, what do? You take the toy away and put the kids in the penalty box. That is kind of like the relationship between Bitcoin and central banks. No human or institution can be trusted with control over the money supply. So the only practical solution is to take away the ability and temptation altogether. The one constant in Bitcoin is its fixed supply. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin, and there is nothing anyone can do about it. Everything will change around Bitcoin, but its supply as a constant will increasingly become the guidepost off of which all other activity is measured. It ensures a level playing field and represents a source of truth, which is absent in the existing economic structure. Because its supply cannot be manipulated, neither can its price signal. Undistorted price signals communicate more perfect information. But never confuse more perfect information and a level playing field with price stability or the issue of volatility. If the value of Bitcoin is $12,000 today and $10,000 tomorrow, that is the undistorted communication of information. Quote, "Variation is information. When there is no variation, there is no information. There is no freedom without noise and no stability without volatility." Taleb and Blythe, Foreign Affairs, May-June 2011 issue. A fixed supply ensures that any change in price is exclusively driven by a change in demand, rather than an artificial and unpredictable change in the supply of money. In other words, communicating a change in preferences to the entire economy. It eliminates an entire side of the equation, which heavily influences changes in prices today, and which distorts the communication of preferences. Imagine knowing with absolute certainty that every change in price were dictated by a change in consumer preferences, rather than the effects of increases or decreases in the money supply. That is the difference between being able to consistently rely on true economic price signals and playing musical chairs, knowing someone else is in control of the stereo. Today and into the future, the same principle will hold true. Everyone will be able to rely upon and trust that changes throughout Bitcoin's price system will always be true and never be influenced by unpredictable changes in supply. This fundamental difference between the existing monetary structure and Bitcoin changes the entire game. False price signals versus true price signals. False price signals are the equivalent to believing you have a cheat sheet for a test, training yourself based on that information, and then showing up only to find out that the test was entirely different. Everyone believes they are responding to true price signals, not realizing that the information communicated would be fundamentally different if the money had not been manipulated. Each time a violent shock occurs within the system, everyone gets a hint that price signals were communicating bad information. But then the Fed steps in to stabilize prices, and everyone becomes reassured that it's okay to come back outside and play, relying on the same bad signals. The primary reason a violent shock to the system is even possible is because this process has occurred every time the economy has attempted to structurally rebalance over the past 50 years. Bad signals attempt to correct only to be sustained and exacerbated by exogenous forces. With a fixed money supply, the wrong is permanently righted. It will no longer be possible to sustain imbalance. So long as Bitcoin exists, the monetary medium will not be capable of distributing distorted price signals. There is a difference between right, wrong, and true. True price signals merely ensure that the information being communicated is reflective of the individual and aggregate preferences of an economy. In that sense, there is no right or wrong, so long as the information can reasonably be relied upon as accurate and undistorted. No one has to trust or question whether Bitcoin's price signals are true, because its fixed supply will guarantee it. And no longer does anyone need to figure out how to play a rigged game, because that game is ending. The days of monetary inequity will soon be past as Bitcoin distributes throughout the world. It will shift the balance of power back to those that actually create value, as defined by true price signals, which are communicated by individuals that hold the currency. Setting aside taxes and regulatory capture for a moment, if one wants to acquire Bitcoin, he or she will have to provide value in return, and Bitcoin will become the arbiter of that value. Of 21 million, approximately 18.5 million Bitcoin are already in circulation. The 18.5 million in circulation are all held by some individual or entity. In order to acquire any, Bitcoin must be earned by delivering value to those that hold the currency. Even for those not yet circulating, every single Bitcoin must be earned by contributing value. The same is not true of the current monetary system. In the current structure, dollars can either be earned by delivering value to others within the economy, or conversely, if the Fed decides to hand out more money. This happens quite frequently. Of all the dollars that exist today, over 80% have been created and allocated by the Fed since 2008, rather than by the alternative, delivering value to others within the economy. Which system sounds more fair, balanced, and conducive to aligning incentives throughout an economy over decades and generations? As more people adopt Bitcoin, the currency is transferred from those that have to those that have not. By making the nominal amount of Bitcoin zero sum, it ensures that the economic system is non-zero sum. In order to join the economy, you must deliver value to someone within the network. No value leaks outside the system. No inefficiency can be introduced through the production of money. Whether new entrants are joining the network or trade occurs from within, value is always transferred, and through that transfer, value is actually created. Recall that the valuable function of money is to coordinate economic activity. The production of money, on the other hand, produces no value and only serves to distort and impair the ability of a monetary medium to properly function. The nominal amount of money is not important. What is important is its ability to communicate accurate information to a broad set of economic participants. That is why people demand money. And with a terminal rate of change set at zero, each participant can use Bitcoin to best understand the value of his or her own output relative to that of others and relative to the preferences of others, undistorted by any changes in the money supply. Each person can make better decisions, on average, in the pursuit of his or her own interest, while by definition delivering value to others as a means to that end. A fixed amount of currency plus more people valuing it equals greater distribution of the currency. With a fixed supply, no more than 21 million Bitcoin can ever be saved, and paradoxically, that change in the incentive structure will cause more people to save. By introducing an incentive to save, i.e. a fixed supply, more people will. And as more people save in a currency which has a fixed supply, it results in more and more people owning less and less. But through that function of more people saving, it creates greater stability. Whereas the centralized control of the money supply and the ability to sustain imbalances causes wealth to consolidate, a fixed money supply naturally causes the currency to become further decentralized and more distributed, delivering greater balance. Centralized governance of the money supply allows the distribution to consolidate as new units of the currency are created and as imbalance is sustained. Whereas a decentralized governance model enforcing a fixed supply ensures that the distribution of the currency becomes greater and greater over time. The structure of the currency dictates the opposite effect, and the trend can be seen in actual data. Bitcoin held in smaller denominations continues to grow steadily, while Bitcoin held in larger denominations continues to decline. As the currency and economic system grows, the currency becomes more widely distributed. Rather than consolidate, the currency distributes to more people, and the nominal amount held by each declines, while purchasing power increases. As more people demand the currency, its value rises. However, there is a terminally fixed supply. As increases in demand naturally outpace ever-diminishing increases in supply, there is one principal way to acquire Bitcoin: by delivering value to an existing holder of the currency. The currency transfers from relatively few early holders to a more widely distributed base as a function of time. Everyone wins. The network utility increases as more participants voluntarily opt in, and the distribution of the currency becomes less and less concentrated, ensuring greater balance and reducing systemic risks created by the existence of a few extremely large holders. When the incentives of a monetary medium align both individual and aggregate interests, non-zero-sum outcomes become the default, as does balance. Bitcoin is accessible to anyone, and everyone that chooses to use it is afforded the same protections. Anyone that produces value and exchanges it for Bitcoin is assured that their output will not be devalued in the future merely as a function of someone in a far-off land creating new units of money. Separately, everyone is assured the benefit of undistorted price signals. In Bitcoin, rich and poor are provided these same protections equally. It is no guarantee that someone else will value the currency more or less, but it eliminates the possibility of an involuntary forced devaluation of labor and output stored in a monetary medium, which distorts economic activity and creates false price signals. When presented with that opportunity relative to a certainty of the worst outcome, it becomes a clear choice. Compared to the current economic structure, in which the wealthiest better understand the effects of active monetary debasement and are best equipped to combat and exploit it, there is a reality that those on the lower end of the economic spectrum have more to gain by leveling the playing field. Even still, it is not about rich and poor. Everyone benefits from the elimination of money production and an economy that provides greater balance through the communication of more perfect information. Tweet by Vitalik Buterin. The idea that an individual can have the immutable right to own a fixed percentage of all the world's money indefinitely, on the other hand, feels very oligarchic. In a tweet from 2018, the founder of Ethereum, Vitalik Buterin, beautifully and ironically described the power of holding a currency with a fixed supply that could not be manipulated, while actually arguing for the opposite. He both made the precise argument which central bankers use to defend their actions, while also articulating the power it would place in the holder of a currency with a fixed supply. While Buterin believes it would be oligarchic to have the immutable right to own a fixed percentage of all the world's money indefinitely, what if that right were extended to the poorest people on Earth? What if it were applied equally to every single person on Earth? That is the power of Bitcoin. If you are living in one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere, such as Nicaragua, and choose to exchange your value for Bitcoin, you now have an immutable right to own a fixed percentage of all the world's money indefinitely. Only you can decide when, how, and to whom to transfer that for value received in the future. The poorest in Nicaragua suddenly are elevated to the exact same leveled playing field as a billionaire in New York like Paul Tudor Jones. Within the Bitcoin network, there is no distinction. Equal rights are the default. That cannot and does not exist in the legacy financial system. It is infinitely more oligarchic to indiscriminately devalue someone's monetary savings by increasing the supply of money, while at the same time determining to whom that new money should be, quote, rewarded. There can be no comparison between that world and allowing those that earn money honestly by producing value for others to determine how to best allocate it for value returned in the future. The idea that Bitcoin could solve problems today for rich and poor alike stumps quite a few. Most consider Bitcoin to be a speculative asset, and many will look at its volatility and believe it unfit for people without a level of savings that one could afford to lose. That view is fortunately flat wrong and economically unsupported. It is easy to look at an economic disaster like Venezuela, where the vast majority of people are struggling to have very basic needs fulfilled, and believe reliable access to food, water, power, and healthcare is more important than, quote, buying Bitcoin. However, it is harder to ignore that the economic collapse was caused by a deterioration in the money that previously coordinated economic activity, and that the only long-term solution to build it back up is to use a form of money that better fulfills that coordination function. Reliable access to food, water, power, and healthcare doesn't exist without the use of money to coordinate resources. In rebuilding an economy on top of a new monetary medium, someone has to go first. And just because it is hard to imagine, it does not change the reality that it's the only way out. One action triggers another, and another, and another. Whether it's Venezuela, any other country suffering from rapid economic deterioration, or any poverty-stricken area in the developed world, the need for assistance is immediate. But there is no quick fix. Bitcoin can't remove a socialist dictator. It can't take the kleptocrats out of the kleptocracy. It can't reverse damaging tax policy or social programs. And it can't magically turn poor people into rich people or vice versa. It can, however, solve problems today for anyone that is determined enough to use it, regardless of poverty level or economic status. There is no reason why a superior form of money would perform one function for some and not for others, regardless of wealth, income levels, or any other reason. It is a vicious cycle to break, but the inception point of evaluating any individual or society is finding a way to produce more value than is consumed or demanded of others. The best way to accomplish that goal is by using money to exchange value and coordinate economic activity. Bitcoin isn't just a rich person tool that will become serviceable to poor people once enough rich people have it. That is nonsensical. It is the opposite. It is the best way anyone can level the playing field, regardless of whether the path may be harder for some than others. The demand for money is near universal, and over time, anyone using the form of money with the strongest foundation and the most true price signals will benefit. Whereas the dollar and other fiat currencies are one for a few in the short term and all for none in the long term, Bitcoin is one for all, now and in the future, because it fixes the economic foundation for everyone. Quote, whether in Rome, Constantinople, Florence, or Venice, history shows that a sound monetary standard is a necessary prerequisite for human flourishing, without which society stands on the precipice of barbarism and destruction. Saifedean Ammous, The Bitcoin Standard. Views presented are expressly my own, and not those of Unchained Capital or my colleagues. Thanks to Phil Geiger, Will Cole, and Robert Breedlove for reviewing and providing valuable feedback. Woo, that was a serious piece. I thought I'd be able to like knock this out in like another 30, 35 minutes, but we got a 45-minute run on the end of this piece, but every minute was worth it. I love this one. Another fantastic installment. Before we have to close this one out today, it's still probably going to be a late release. But let's go ahead and hit our sponsor really fast for today's show, and then we will jump back in and get Guy's take on the conclusion of Parker Lewis's Bitcoin is One for All. Man, this series is just a great one. Parker Lewis always kills it with these. One quote that just jumped right out at me, because this is such a difficult thing to articulate and like kind of pinpoint. And I've tried to, like, I've kind of danced around it in a lot of explanations in previous episodes, but just kind of the equations, the charts, and like kind of the data he presented made it so much more clear in this piece exactly why. And it also shows just how a huge part of the inequity in the actual system, how the ability to get credit, i.e. the ability to, you know, be politically well-connected or already wealthy, becomes the dominant factor in how, in whether or not you can actually participate in the system. Because having wealth, actually having capital, isn't the price setter. And so this quote just hit it so cleanly. It says, quote, because the credit system is now orders of magnitude larger than the base money supply, economic activity today is largely coordinated by the allocation and expansion of credit rather than by the base money itself. In aggregate, the credit system is the marginal price setter, given its relative size to the base money supply. And what he's talking about here is the fact that there's like 79 or 78 trillion dollars. I think it's 79. It was 78 not too long ago. Somewhere in there, trillion dollars worth of all sector debt and liabilities. So that is the level of credit in the system, whereas the money, the actual base money supply, just after the Fed printed like $3 trillion, is only $4.7 trillion, which means that the only way to participate in the economy, to actually play on the level of prices that are set by the system, is to be a participant in the credit system, because the credit system is what is dictating how high the prices are. It is the marginal price setter. So whereas somebody with capital might have $20,000 to buy a house, it's how much debt someone can afford that determines that the house is $200,000, because that $20,000 can fund or can justify $200,000 in debt. So rather than the house being $20,000, which it was what it would be if everybody was spending actual money on houses, rather than being dominated by the credit system, well, then now they have to pay that price. And the only way to get the house is through credit. That's how you maintain these, you know, 10x, 15x, like price house increases over 30-year spans. And that's how you get the economy into a situation where people just like, oh, well, with deflationary money, without being able to get debt, how would you buy a house? It's like, you would do it with money. It's only because of the disastrous imbalance and the fact that the credit system itself is the price setter, because it's such an, it's an expansion that's, you know, what is it, 17 times the base monetary supply? It's only because of that that the house is so expensive to actually get in the first place. It wouldn't be that expensive without that system. So you wouldn't be doing, go back, look back 50 years, ask your grandparents, how much money did you have to have down? What were the actual interest rate? What was it like when they originally bought a house? It's night and day. It looks nothing like today's system. Why? Because they actually had some degree of sound money. It wasn't really, but it was orders of magnitude better than what we have today. It's just got progressively worse through, 50 years of manipulation and constant propping up of imbalance. It just gets worse and worse with every cycle that we go through. And, it's been sustained lower and lower interest rates, and the Fed manipulates to keep the imbalance running, to keep the people who have been making all the bad decisions and destroying resources in the economy with the prices that sustained the ability for them to do that. For that glorious mandate of stabilizing prices. I love that little clip of Jerome Powell where he just completely dodges the inequality question. I mean, he says it takes him three times of repeating the same thing a different way of I don't think it was the central bank, but there's lots of reasons, but it wasn't the central bank, and there are definitely many reasons, but there's a lot of theories. It's just complete nonsense answer, and then finally lands on globalization and new technology. So sad. Parker does a great job of actually the quote. I've got it right here. Yeah, okay, here. Never believe the myths about globalization and technology driving wealth inequality. There is nothing about technology, innovation, and globalization that causes sustained economic imbalance or a structurally expanding wealth gap within an economy. And he goes a little bit deeper into this as well. But just the basic idea, technology, innovation, and globalization means we have a further division of labor, we have further specialization, and would necessitate that the economy as a whole, and most importantly, the lowest in society, the people on the lowest rung, actually benefit the most. That has nothing to do with inequality, because the people who have the least are the ones that benefit the most from the excess production, from the ability to essentially provide services on a new level. But he goes a little bit deeper into that, just talking about the idea of an innovation is only valuable because it can produce value to more people. Like if Apple created an iPhone that only five people could afford, it would basically be worthless because only five people can afford it. It is explicitly because they figure out a way for that innovation to be affordable by a billion people that makes it such a powerful increase in the standard of living and the capability of the average person. The value of the innovation literally necessitate that it's helping as many people as possible. The fewer people it helps, the more worthless it is. It's circular. If it's not helping anybody, then it's not an innovation. It's not a useful new technology. And outside of the people who are getting money by manipulating the credit system or being close to the credit issuers, the way to make money in society is to be able to provide some sort of a higher standard of living or provide a solution to someone's problem at a lower cost or more efficient manner to as many people as possible. And that necessitates how you are successful in an economy. Extremely limited number of people are willing to spend more money on a shittier service when there's an alternative available. I don't know anybody who was I could do this in an hour and it would be really easy, but I could also work much, much harder and get a whole lot less for it if I take a day or two. That's not really a problem with society that we have, that people don't want things to be better. And this is so hard for people to imagine, and it's for a very simple reason, a very intuitive reason. You can't predict the future. Nobody can see the future. So all they see is they project this linear path out. They see the world as it is today and fewer jobs. And it's it's so hard to just be you have to understand that the incentives and the structure of just the nature of humanity is that when we have excess, when we produce something, when we have something that takes you know, 100,000 people to do, and suddenly we have this innovation that makes it require two people to do that job. That doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean that 98,000 people are out of a job. It means that now we can produce enough for 100,000 people with just two people. It necessitates the fact that we have made a way to take a tiny, tiny fraction of the number of resources and man hours to produce a vastly more amount of goods, to achieve a far, far higher productivity. And that is good because it means that whatever you purchase is likely to be 98% less expensive, whatever the product is of that process. And whatever it's connected to, whatever it's used for, or whatever other process it's replacing, those things fall in cost and in the labor and resources. That is the key to actually creating wealth. And a job is ethereal anyway. It's a temporary thing. It's only useful if it's actually producing something good. The last thing we want to do is put everybody into a job digging holes with spoons. Like, we could do that and everybody could get paid a lot, but all we would have is to trade a bunch of holes that nobody wants. The point is to produce value efficiently. There is no benefit to throwing away resources when we can do it better and cheaper some other way. You know, before the Industrial Revolution, is like 95% of the economy was employed in farming. And post-Industrial Revolution, you know, go forward 100 years, and now it's like 4% or 5% or something like that. Do we have 95% unemployment? No. We have whole industries that couldn't exist while everybody was busy picking sweet potatoes out of the ground. We have the internet thanks to this. We've solved a billion on top of a billion other problems because we had the free labor and we had the free mind share of all of those people that were wasted picking tobacco and sweet potatoes and farming cattle when now we can do it with a 20th of the people and produce for everyone. It made everyone so much wealthier. That innovation is what makes it so that we can have a mobile phone in our pocket and people who specialize in figuring out how to design those things. And then people who's a whole nother industry on top of it that specialize how to write code to install on the thing. None of that is possible if we're all focused on trying to keep our jobs at farming. And in some sense, that's part of what the Fed is doing. They're trying to stabilize prices and prevent that variation that allows those adjustments to happen. That's why corporations and structures that literally would normally run a loss are being propped up with prices that make no sense, that are false price signals to the preferences of people in the actual market economy. And obviously, he you know, articulates this incredibly well in this whole piece and hits it by about 10 different directions to make it vastly clear that what we have are false signals. What we have are what we are dealing with is a lie as to what the economy wants, what the preferences are, and most importantly, what is sustainable and profitable. We're being cheated out of accurate decisions in place of the decisions that the Federal Reserve wants us to make. And what decisions do they want us to make? To keep the status quo going the way it is, because their mandate is price stability. So whatever used to be the thing that everybody was putting money in, well, we're just going to sustain those markets because, you know, we don't want prices to be volatile. Well, what does that mean? That means that if the economy shifts, if technology shifts, if the people shift, they're actively doing everything they can to make sure that the prices don't adjust with them, which means we're being cheated out of the future. We're being cheated out of those efficiency gains. We are necessarily propping up a zombie economy and keeping ourselves in the past and not benefiting from the extra productivity. And that's what you see. You go to the WTF happened in 1971 stuff. What happens is people don't get paid for the extra productivity. It doesn't get distributed. It is the source of the inequity in the system. And it's just, it's crazy how connected all this stuff is. And, you know, Parker Lewis does another good analogy in this one of just like, you know, if we're talking about, you know, regulations and taxes and all this like super out there, like high level stuff, all this like kind of surface, you know, rocky water on the surface kind of thing. What we're doing essentially is trying to change out the windows or, you know, argue about the window frames or whatever it is on the 100th floor of the building. Whereas the first 10 floors are all on just like one Jenga tile. And that's truly it, is the foundation is corrupt and we can't even know to the extent that those regulations and all the stuff on the 100th floor are misguided or like exactly what the damage of those things are, because we don't even have a foundation to work from. We don't even have a real pricing system to figure out where it's pushing us. So like we just inherently are misallocating across the board. We simply don't have the most important tool. We don't have honesty in the most important information metric in the economy. Therefore, any secondary measurements we make are worthless. You know, like if I'm trying to compare my house to the next person's house and, you know, judge, I don't know, some decision to, you know, change something on the house or add something on the house, but we can't even compare the measurements. Our inches aren't even the same. Well, then any assessment we make of the next thing that we do is necessarily going to be built upon a foundation of completely garbage information. If we're both using elastic tape measures, it's just about whose is more elastic. It just, there are no base measurements to start from. The foundation of how we make the comparison is broken. And that's where another great quote that he has in this is that, quote, "The core problem that Bitcoin solves is the foundation. If everyone were to display a little bit of humility, each would recognize that there is no silver bullet to solve the structural problem of a widening wealth gap and economic imbalance. There is no individual with a plan or piece of legislation that will make everything better. Imbalance created by central command does not get solved by central command. Quite the opposite. The only real hope is to first fix the foundation such that everyone on net can get back to doing the desirable things without the need for conscious control. Balance will follow from there." And in that section, that's where he's got that beautiful quote from Hayek, which, you know what, I'll read that too. I love this quote. And this is, again, from The Use of Knowledge in Society, which I've probably recommended 80 times on this show. And I have read on the show so that you can easily go back and get it. In fact, just because I'm going to go ahead and just look it up, Use of Knowledge in Society, read 250 and 251. That is parts 1 and 2. Of Hayek's Use of Knowledge. And so, you know, it definitely needs its own like full read, no commentary, just for people who just want to jump in and listen to that piece, because that's just such a good one. But here's the quote. "But those who clamor for conscious direction and who cannot believe that anything which has evolved without design, and even without our understanding it, should solve problems which we should not be able to solve consciously, should remember this. The problem is precisely how to extend the span of our utilization of resources beyond the span of the control of any one mind, and therefore how to dispense with the need of conscious control, and how to provide inducements which will make the individuals do the desirable things without anyone having to tell them what to do." Such a good quote. That is the very problem. How do we create a system in which it doesn't need to be centrally managed? Because the economy is an organic thing. And it's so vast and it's so complex and there's so many trillions of transactions going on all the time. The idea of trying to consciously control it is laughable. The very point of a strong, sound money is to make sure there is a foundation of accurate information exchange so that the people are actually induced to make the proper decisions without needing to try to aggregate all the information in some committee or with a bunch of arrogant experts who think they can better direct the resources than the people on the ground with skin in the game. And the best, I think the analogy that he uses, I think it's the copper analogy, that there's like a, you know, a hurricane or an earthquake or something in Chile or something like that. And like some major copper mines all collapse, and suddenly copper is, you know, a couple of months down the road is going to be incredibly scarce. And on the, you know, overnight markets or whatever, the price of copper skyrockets because this news spreads. And suddenly everybody who is about to use copper for something is seeing that the price of copper is like 2x, 3x what it was. And that they don't have to know. Like, they could be halfway around the world, have no clue that the earthquake happened, have no clue that, you know, all these contracts bounced across, like, and, you know, people settled and, you know, took profits and moved and are now investing in, you know, some new copper mine somewhere, because now the new price justifies the fact that, you know, this previously wasn't going to be profitable mine now should be opened up because we're about to have a huge scarcity in the actual copper supply, and that all these people, everything immediately aligns. The people who weren't going to invest in copper now have turned around and been like, this is now what's profitable in the market. Everybody who was going to use copper for something frivolous or not super necessary are deterred. They're not going to buy the copper, which leaves more of the copper good available to the people who really need the copper and can't use any alternative. So maybe the other person buys zinc or aluminum or something instead. Maybe there's something that serves the purpose better or in a short-term fashion, or maybe they just defer it. Maybe they're just like, I didn't need to do it this month. I'll just wait 6 months until the price of copper comes back down. And at the same time, everybody who does have a copper mine that's active is encouraged to double the number of people they hire, because now they can afford, now that the price of copper is higher, they can afford to hire more people and increase their production, which everybody is aligned to correct the problem just by looking at the price. They don't have to know the magnitude of the earthquake. They don't have to know where it was. They don't have to know what happened. The price itself illustrates the degree that everyone is changing their decisions. And you could very well see the price come all the way back down to that equilibrium price in the face of it, because everybody who had a mine produced, you know, pumped up the output. Everybody who didn't need to use it decided not to. And everybody who could have just waited decided to wait. And everybody has immediately changed their behavior and has immediately made the aligned decisions with the economic reality without having to be told what to do. The price was the metric on the dashboard that allowed everybody to account for all of this information that no one person could ever have known anyway. You can't assess, you can't just like pull in charts from the whole freaking economy all over the world and think that you're going to plan it better than the individual subjective valuations of all the people who needed it for one reason or the other. The people with the skin in the game are the only ones that are going to make the accurate decisions. And it's their very valuations that determine what the price is. So if you're leading the price, all you're doing is pretending that you can guess everybody's valuations better than the valuation, than the people would actually value it themselves, which is really just an absurd idea. And how is it allowed to happen? How is all of this alignment able to play out? Price volatility. Variation is allowed. Imbalance is not allowed to be sustained. Now imagine if the Fed comes in and sees this price of copper skyrocketing and instead puts in, you know, the government puts in price controls and they, you know, pump up the number of like futures, unbacked futures contracts to sell copper to push the price back down. And the person who didn't need to use copper decides to use copper anyway. And then suddenly nobody can get copper. Everybody's supposedly, quote unquote, buying it up, but there doesn't seem to be any to actually fulfill the orders. You sustain the imbalance out of some fear of the variation in the price, when the variation itself is the transmission of information that is critical to actually allowing the economy to work, actually enabling it to function with true information. All you do is cover up the reality. Just like in yesterday's episode, the temperature, manipulating the thermometer does not solve the disease. It does not get rid of the infection. All it does is cover up the fact that there's an infection there in the first place and that we should alter our behavior to account for it. And Bitcoin is the cure. Bitcoin is the is what will solve that infection. It is what will heal the body. And it's not just for the rich. It's not just for, you know, people in the modern world. It's and that was like one of the greatest things about that last section was that, you know, it's like, oh, well, poor people in Venezuela can't use it right now. Some people can't, I don't know, transfer or use a wallet or whatever it is. But that's completely ignoring the fact that the only reason the people in Venezuela can't afford it is because they didn't have an accurate monetary system to begin with. They didn't have sound money. That's why their whole economy was obliterated. Yes, it can help them. Any amount of access and use for anyone in that economy is a means of slowly integrating a real pricing mechanism and a actual sound monetary foundation to start from. The only thing you can do is start from scratch. You've already been forced to because the money is collapsed. And if you try to use Venezuelan bolivars, the problem will never get solved. The only solution is a new foundation. And as Parker Lewis says so well in this piece, Bitcoin is one for all. It is not, its fiat currency is for a few in the short term and for nobody in the long term. Bitcoin is one for all now and in the future because it rebalances the economy and it fixes the very nature of exchange and the ability to communicate value between people. And that is the source of society. Trade and money is the source of economic prosperity. And, you know, thank God we got Bitcoin, right? Because Jesus, that fiat system sucks. All right, guys. I guess we'll close it out here. I don't think I have anything else. Let me check my quotes, make sure I didn't skip over anything. Yeah, I got it all. Okay. Another great installment. Thank you to Parker Lewis, as always, for these fun pieces. There's so much fun to dive into. Of course, Unchained Capital for all of the stuff that, I mean, we've read a couple of great pieces from Phil Geiger over there. Like their multi-sig stuff is awesome. In fact, I just read, if you haven't checked it out on their blog, they just released an announcement about their multi-sig, like integrating better with Trezor, and they've made a couple of like significant multi-sig updates and making that easier to use. And I'm a huge fan of Caravan. That's actually what I was talking about, Swan Bitcoin, you know, and how it auto withdraws to my keys. That is a Caravan multi-sig wallet that I'm using. So I highly recommend checking out multi-sig if you haven't yet. It is the most secure way to hold Bitcoin savings. And it really gets rid of that single point of failure. Will Cole had a great presentation at BitBlock Boom. I will link that out on Twitter when that's actually available. The video is actually available for it. Because that was one of my favorite presentations. All the elements of kind of the security trade-offs and benefits of multi-sig, and he actually had a really interesting new element of security that you get with multi-sig that I didn't quite think about, which I thought was really, really cool. But I'll save that. Maybe we'll have him on the show, or I'll do a whole episode maybe reading some of their thing about multi-sig, or just do a guy's take. I don't know. But multi-sig is definitely going to be something that comes back, and Unchained Capital is a literal pioneer in making that both a service to provide to people and building really easy open source tools. So, you know, massive applause to those guys for the stuff that they're doing over there. With that, don't forget to, stack with swanbitcoin.com/guy. That'll get you $10 free to start off your Bitcoin savings plan. Auto withdrawal, auto auto buy every week. Mine's every week. I do $50 every week, and I try to stack a little bit extra with Strike and Cash App whenever I can. But Swan's the one with the lowest fees, so I always have that buy running. And then, of course, auto withdrawal to my keys, my multi-sig caravan wallet. So don't forget to use swanbitcoin.com/guy to get $10 free to start off and support this wonderful show, Bitcoin Audible with Guy Swan. We have got some really great reads and episodes coming for the rest of this week and next week, so do not forget to subscribe so you don't miss them. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you all in our glorious Bitcoin future. And until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.